My name is Sandy, and I am a grateful recovering alcoholic. Woo! Are you having fun yet? Good, good. You better believe, I absolutely insist upon enjoying life, and I hope you do too. I'm just going to give you a quick story so it'll kind of make me relax here a little bit. I was down in Williamsburg, Virginia for a get-together not too long ago, and they had an entourage from Richmond, Virginia. Anybody from Richmond? Nope. Woo! Okay. They put their pigeons, we call them pigeons, our sponsees, put them to work. There was this panel of beautiful blonde-haired girls, looked like they were in their 20s, gorgeous. They came to their podium, and this is what their sponsor instructed them to do. Identify their name, that they were alcoholic, that they were sponsored, that they had a home group and where it was, and that they had a service position. This is what one cute little blonde said. My name is, and she stammered, oh, by the way, I am alcoholic. And she said, oh, yeah, I have a sponsor who's sponsored, and I have a home group. And that home group meets on Monday night at 8 o'clock, and she named the place. And she was so nervous, she said, and we're called the Easy Women's Group. I can relate to that anyway. And the other quick one I'm going to say before I do all this preliminary here, when I first came in, if there are any newcomers here today, just keep coming back. More will be revealed. I got that bumper sticker for my little red sports car that said, keep it simple. I pulled into the Shenandoah Valley Golf Course. My son was working there at the time in Front Royal, Virginia. And this gentleman golfer was putting his clubs away in his car, and he looked over at that bumper sticker and smiled. I didn't know who the founders were at that time. He looked at me and said, oh, are you friends with Bill W.? I said, yeah, he's the man that sold me this car. I thought it was Bill Walker, the salesman from Winchester Ford Company, you know. Go figure. Okay. I think I'm relaxed now. Thank you. I do want to ask us to pause for a moment of silence and gratitude for our AA recoveries of the past 75 years. So if you could just have a moment of silence. Thank you. And because I told you about the other girl in Williamsburg, I'm going to tell you quickly, my name is Sandy. I am a grateful recovering alcoholic. My home group is the country group of Ashburn in Ashburn, Virginia. I have a sponsor who sponsors. My sponsor is in the front row of 33 years sober. And thank you. And I do maintain service. I sponsor ladies also. And I maintain a service position as DCM in our District 10 in Loudoun County now. And I take meetings into the jail facilities, the work release program. So having said that, thank you. I'm going to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Libby. And Libby, come on up. You're from Montana, right? Welcome, Libby.
All right. So I tend to be soft-spoken as well, so you let me know. My name is Libby. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is March 25th, 2000. It was my millennium resolution, and it just took me till March to get to it. So, my home group is the Flathead Valley Serenity Group in Kalispell, Montana, up in the northwest corner by Glacier National Park. We have meetings every Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 7 o'clock behind the KFC. So if you're up there, come and see us. I have a sponsor, and she's not here. She decided to go to a different meeting, but I told her she could. So, I'm just, you know, really, really excited to be here. I knew the room was big. I was hoping not as many people would come into the room, but, you know. Getting started is the hardest part of this anyway. But there's a guy in my home group that recently said something, and he said there's things that when I'm sitting here, two types of people, those that are listening and those that are waiting to speak. And I tend to be the one sitting there waiting to speak, not listening, so I'm glad I'm going first so I can listen to these guys. But I'd add a third category, those that are regretting what they didn't say. So I'm hoping I don't go into that category when I'm done here. But So the topic of this meeting is, do you think you're different? And, you know, it's a great topic. So it's always nice to have a little audience participation, right, to get involved and get engaged. And so how many of you in here think you're different? All right. So how many people in here think you're not different? All right. So, and that's kind of what as I, you know, I've had a little while to think about this, unfortunately. But that's kind of what I saw, is that there's really two answers to that. You know, do I think I'm different? Yes, I think I'm so very different than every single one of you guys. But yet, fortunately, I also think I'm exactly the same. So what I think about is the disease of alcoholism when I think about this, and that's one of my favorite topics. So it's kind of like the first thing we have to do is identify the problem, you know. I have to identify that I'm an alcoholic and to remember that not everyone in this world has this disease, you know. We're really kind of the minority. It's hard to believe that as you're walking around downtown San Antonio this weekend, but you know, it's kind of nice to be in the majority for a while. But on page 30 of our big book, I really liked what it says here. There's a paragraph in More About Alcoholism that Bill wrote, that we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people, or presently maybe, has to be smashed. So right in our book says, I'm not like other people. I'm different. And, you know, that's the first thing I have to admit. I have to accept that I am different, you know, and in all of this, the part of the disease, the three parts of the disease, the physical craving, the mental obsession, the spiritual malady, and I always say I could win a pageant, I could be Miss Spiritual Malady, so that's a, I need a sash, but, you know, in the doctor's opinion, it says that, you know, that physical craving never happens in the average temperate drinker. So I forgot to ask at the beginning, any average temperate drinkers in the room? Oh, not me. Sorry, I can't put my hand up on that one. So I was hoping there would be. At least there's some out in the halls, I know. But you know, there are average temperate drinkers. And I'm different from them. You know, and I think I live with some of those people. I know I work with some of those people. And so my life is, you know, full of those people. So I have to first decide that I'm not an average temperate drinker, that I am physically and mentally different than lots of people in this world. You know, that physical craving never happens in the average temperate drinker. The mental obsession, we've lost the power of choice. I've lost the power of choice. You know, a lot of people talk about the drugs they used to do so they could drink more, and you know, one of the drugs I used to do so I could drink more was Maalox, because, you know, my stomach would get so upset, you know, and I was like, I can't go out and drink. I can't even imagine doing that. You know, the most insane thing about that is that I did that stone cold sober. You know, to be able to drink, I had to do something to do that. And so, you know, that's how exciting my story is, you know. That was before Pepcid and Tagamet and all that stuff. But, you know, and Maalox tastes pretty bad, worse than alcohol, I think. But, you know, in normal people, they don't count how many days they've been sober. You know, you don't hear somebody, it's been 56 days since I had a drink. And it's like, oh, you know, and I'm like every minute since that time. And the other thing about the spiritual malady with normal people is that alcohol doesn't fix it. With the spiritual malady is that alcohol doesn't fix that condition that I have so well, you know, that round peg in a square hole. You know, and so that's why I think we have it better than the Al-Anons, because at least we had something that relieved it for a while, you know, something that would fix all of that. So, you know, I had to say, when my first sponsor said, we're going to start going through the book and we'll decide if you're an alcoholic. Well, I thought that meant that maybe it was because my case was different, that we had to decide if I was an alcoholic or not. Not that she says that to everybody she works with. She could tell that maybe I wasn't. And you know, we had to, you know, make sure. But the first thing that I had to do was say, yes, I am different. And I'm different than about 90% of the world. And that's where, that's where things got to really start. And I was probably a couple years sober before I fully conceded that I had this disease of alcoholism. Fully accepted that. You know, intellectually, yes, I got it early. But, you know, I knew you guys had it. And I could see it in you, and that was good. And it was good that you guys recognized that you had it. But I should have known better. You know, I was smarter than that. You know, I was educated. I have a college education. Damn it, I can read. I know what's going on here, and I should have known better. I never should have gotten myself into that situation. But you guys, yeah, you know, that's how it was. I believe it for you. And it took me a while to really say, yes, I have that physical craving when I drink. You know, I can't control what's going to happen next. I maybe did drink one or two drinks every once in a while and not get drunk and not have to keep going. So, you know, I clung on to those few times that happened. But I couldn't say that it was going to be one, or I couldn't say that it was going to be 17, you know. And I had to admit and fully realize that there was always something else that stopped me from not drinking more. It wasn't because I did it. I was a great martyr. It would be if I had to drive home, you know, I could stop. If I had to work the next day, there were some times that I could stop, you know. But there was always something. It wasn't just because I wanted to stop. And that I heard a speaker tape early on that this young lady said that she was addicted to the feeling of intoxication. And that's me, exactly. That it's not always alcohol that I identify with, you know. It's alcohol and other drugs and men and anything that makes me feel better is what I'm addicted to. And but alcohol is one of those things, so I get to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm excited about that. So I admitted that I was mentally and physically different than my fellows. But now that I'm an alcoholic, I have to step back and say that I'm not different from you guys. Like I said, I'm a college graduate. I graduated from pharmacy school in South Dakota State University in 1988, moved to California. And so, as you may guess, I have some problems other than alcohol. And it's mostly an access thing. And so when I got here, when I went to treatment, I wasn't thinking alcohol. But when I got to treatment and they made us go to NA meetings, they made us go to AA meetings, at first it was a little bit difficult to do that identification because I wasn't a bad enough addict because I was a pretty white-collar, high-bottom addict. I wasn't a bad enough alcoholic because I was a pretty high-bottom alcoholic, you know, but the two together was enough, you know. I wanted to die, but, that's what I told my husband kind of early on. I was at some conference, and we talked about high bottoms, low bottoms, and I said, you know, I think I had a pretty high bottom, and he looked at me and said, I'm pretty sure I didn't want you to go any lower, but, so it was, you know, it was low enough for sure, you know, just not wanting to live anymore. Being willing to, I don't know about willing, but doing things that good wives don't do, doing things that good mothers don't do. So I went into treatment on my son's 8th birthday. That's a way to feel like a really good mother. But in hindsight, that was probably the best birthday present I ever gave that kid. He graduated from high school this spring, and I'm really, really proud of him. He applied to several colleges. In one of his college essays, he had to write about one of the greatest challenges of his life. And he said, you know, it started out the essay, "My mom's an alcoholic," and she decided, you know, basically to do something about it. And she went back to school and left me and my sister and my dad at home while she went to school. And that was one of the challenging times of his life. But he was glad because things were better. He doesn't remember a whole lot at that, you know, when he was 8. He just knows something crazy was happening. But, that he learned how to be a brother and a helper, and he learned how to make scrambled eggs and toast. That was what he learned out of that whole situation. So I think, I don't know why I went off on that tangent, but maybe I'm hungry. But, you know, that was just those kind of things that were going on in my life. I went to treatment, trying to decide what was I. And you know, that third tradition is so important to me. You know, the only requirement for membership here is the desire to stop drinking. And thank God I knew I didn't want to drink anymore, that I didn't get hung up on the fact that narcotics were the big deal in my life. And that alcohol, you know, I've got it. That you couldn't say I couldn't come because I had other issues. Because I was still kind of, you know, that you against me stuff. You know, you can't tell me I can't come, but would you please let me? That's really my personality. Please. So anyway, accepting that I'm not terminally unique, you know, we all have different stories that my brother, I told you I was in college, I went on a study abroad to France, you know, I'm in pharmacy school, I have this wonderful boyfriend who's going to be a doctor, and I was going to France, and my brother was getting DUIs and going to treatment, you know, he's an alcoholic, I'm not, just because I would drink too much and think the next day that I really shouldn't do this and then go out one night and not drink a whole bunch and not go home with somebody I didn't know and think, oh, maybe I should do that more often. You know, that didn't mean I was an alcoholic. You know, I'm going to France. And so, I have my husband's niece who went to treatment in January of 2000. And, you know, she had some other issues, too, but she didn't come to AA, and she didn't go to meetings. She didn't stop drinking, and in July of 2000, she hung herself, you know. It's just like the only difference between the two of us is that I hung around. That was a gift that I was given, that I recognized that, not that, oh, man, I'm so much better than her. The gift that I took advantage and hung in here, even though not everyone around me wanted me to do this, or not everyone around me understood why I was doing this, why I quit my job and stopped making any money and, you know, all that kind of stuff, why I thought I wanted to go back to school when I had a perfectly good career, you know, all those things, why I had to still go to meetings, do all this stuff, why I had to meet with that lady and that lady reads to you, you know, that was what my 4-year-old daughter, you know, was like, well, is she that lady that comes over and reads to you, you know? And, you know, here I am, the college graduate, being read to, but, you know, I couldn't get it on my own. It's just like, you know, it's just so amazing that I have to say, yes, I'm different. One of those paradoxes that I have to say, yes, I am different, and then I have to turn around the next phase and say, but I'm not, you know? And I am different than the fellows as far as alcohol is concerned, but I also have to remember that we're all human beings as well, and that you know, God loves everyone as much as he loves me. And I am not special, and that I'm not extra. You know, when I went into treatment, part of my problem was that I thought I had more to lose than you did, you know? I was convinced that I had more to lose than you did, and that set me apart. You know, I was going to lose my job, my license, you know, my family, my everything. Didn't dawn on me at the time that you might lose your job, your license, your family, your, you know, everything. But mine was more important, you know. Mine was more than yours, and so I had more to lose than you. And one of my first spiritual experiences was that, I think after reading in our book, the Dr. Alcoholic Addict, that story, which is now Acceptance is the Key, is the Answer, or something like that, that was where I first related to this disease. You know, I'm the same. And after I read that, maybe, is when that aha moment came that I have nothing more than anyone else in this whole entire world to lose. And I need to just, you know, buck it up and quit thinking that I was so special. But in my whole life, there's kind of been three types of people in my life. You know, there's people who are better than me, there's people who are less than me, and then there's me. And me is a very lonely place to live. And, you know, I still do that, and I usually end up with, you know, the most of the world's better than me. But that's how I cope, you know, or that's how I used to cope all the time. That's how I sometimes cope now. And, you know, and what I want everybody to be there with me. But, you know, my ego's wants more, you know, like we all do. I want to be more. I want to be special, but, oh, my God, don't notice me, you know, because if you notice me, I might do something stupid and then you'll think I'm bad, you know. I might make all this, you know, I'm going to make a fool of myself if you pay attention, but I really want you to pay attention, but, you know, and that's just, it's like exhausting to live, to live in that world. And you know, I just really do pray that you know, I think that's one of my character defects, you know, that living in that world of being different as far as that's concerned. And I really, really want to feel like everyone's the same, and that I don't have to compare myself to you to get my worth. And that's, you know, that's the only way I know how to be, really, is that's how I know what's going on, is if I can compare myself. So I want to stop doing that. So if you guys have any tips later on, you can let me know. You know, I wanted to be cute. I wanted to be special. You know, I wanted to be someone you would abdicate the throne for. You know, not just somebody you might have over on Saturday night. You know, and so, you know, it's a very difficult place to live in, especially when you're shy and you know you don't meet potential royals that way. You know, when you're shy and live in Iowa, you know, it's a hard place to be. But anyway, I'll just finish with, y'all know that there is a pamphlet, Do You Think You're Different? My sponsor is the district literature chair, so she let me know right away that, oh, have you read the pamphlet? And I first said, well, I wrote it. And then, oh, you mean there really is a pamphlet? Okay, I'll have to look at that. The last paragraph on this, actually, one thing I really like in this book, there's a guy that's Jewish, you know, and it's all about these stories about people that are different. And there's a Jewish guy there, and he talks about this billboard. He thinks it's in New York City. This very obviously Irish cop guy on a billboard with a corned beef sandwich, and it says, you don't have to be Jewish to eat at Levinson's Deli or something like that. And he said he wants to make a billboard with a picture of him on there who's obviously ethnically Jewish, and says, you don't have to be Irish to be an alcoholic. And I thought that was great. So that's all in here. It's great material. So I'll finish with this last paragraph that says, we have found it unwise to limit our AA circle to folks exactly like ourselves. Segregation gives our uniqueness an unhealthy emphasis. We find it more enjoyable and more healing to get into the mainstream of AA life and mingle with everybody else, not just different people. Here we are. We are all different. We're all pretty special people, but we are also all alcoholics and all sober in AA together. In this, we are more like each other than different. Here in AA, we find the shared humanity that enables us to live out our widely different lives and pursue our separate and individual destinies. You are welcome to join us. And so I'd like to change that. You're welcome to join me on this great ride. Thanks.
Thank you, Libby. Our next speaker is Gary G, and he's from Nevada. Or Nevada, however you want to pronounce it. Hey, Gary.
Hi, everybody. I'm Gary. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Gary.
Thanks to the guy that got me involved in this. One of my sponsees asked me if I would talk at a meeting if he put my name in the hat, and I said, feel free. And so I found out that I was going to talk, and I found out that the talk was on Do You Think You're Different? And I went up to him. I said, Starlin, I said, how is it that you managed to get me into a meeting where the topic is Do You Think You're Different? And he fell off his chair laughing, but he never answered my question. I want to thank everybody for allowing me to be a part of this. It's a privilege and it's an honor, and it really is incredible. I have a home group in Reno, Nevada, the sobriety capital of the United States, and it's the Men's Treasures on Wednesday night. It's on Wells Avenue. If you ever come to Reno, join us. It's a good meeting. I love it. I really do. Men talking to men. It's something I need. I used to come to meetings with mixed meetings all the time, and then I started hearing how men get more honest about men's stuff with men, and I like that. My home group used to be in the Nugget in Sparks. Sparks is right next to Reno, like Twin Cities, and it's a casino hotel, big. And for 15 years, that was my home group. And it was the only meeting I've ever seen with valet parking. If you don't believe me, come on down. You'll see. My sobriety date is 11/11/84. And I was... Thank you. Thank you. I was over at the Sober City looking at their jewelry, the things they had for sale. And I was looking for a tie pin. A tie tack, because I didn't bring one for my tie. And I was looking at all the different jewelry counters, and I saw the guy standing there. He's pretty young. I said, "Do you have any tie tacks?" And he looks at me and he says, "Sir, we have to charge tax on everything we sell." I said, no, a tie pin, you know, to hold your tie still. And he looks at the guy next to him who was older, and he says, "What is he asking me for?" And he says, "Never mind. No, sir, we don't have any." I guess young people nowadays don't wear tie pins. I don't know. But I was impressed when I found some. They had the number of years on them. And I was looking for one with 25, and there weren't any. This was Thursday. They were out of 25-year, 26-year, 27-year, 28-year. I feel like I'm preaching to the choir. A lot of people tell me I'm too serious, so I have to lighten up as often as possible. I want to thank the people that are here to support me. I appreciate you being here. Dave, Kane, some others. I get a little emotional once in a while, and I'm sorry. No, I'm not really sorry. It's good to get emotional. You know, every once in a while, I hear people share, and they have more defects than I do. They have a bad life. They're problem people. And when I hear them share, my problems just seem to diminish. And it's just kind of a boost, and I feel better. And I'd like to thank Kane and Dave for doing that. I grew up in Southern California. My father was an alcoholic. My mother was an alcoholic. So I was doomed genetically. And I think kids learn what they live. They say it's the parents' fault. A lot of people say it's the parents' fault how kids turn out. I don't believe it, but I think it does have an effect on the kids, how they think. But I'm thinking of these two brothers that I knew. And one was 7 years old and one was 5 years old. And they were being raised by their alcoholic father. I don't know what happened to their mother, but he was raising these boys. And one morning they were getting ready for school upstairs, and the 7-year-old turns to the 5-year-old and he says, "You know," he says, "I've been thinking." He says, "I think I'm old enough to cuss." And the 5-year-old thinks a minute and says, "Yeah, me too." And the 7-year-old says, "Well, I thought it over, and I think I'm old enough to say ass." And the 5-year-old thinks a minute and he says, "I think I'm old enough to say damn." So they're going downstairs getting ready for school, talking it over, and they go into the kitchen, and the old man was going to cook us some breakfast, and he'd had a bad night. He wasn't feeling too good anyway. He says, "What do you guys want for breakfast?" And the 5-year-old says, "I guess I'll have some damn cornflakes." And the old man stopped what he was doing, and he looks over at him and says, "What did you say?" And he repeated it. Being the good alcoholic that he was, he whipped him. He whipped him good. He got all done whipping him, and he looks over at the 7-year-old, and he says, "And what do you want?" He says, "Well, you can bet your ass I don't want no cornflakes." I don't know about this being different much. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1980. I was kind of scared of losing my job because I was a bread man and I used to drink every day while I was driving my bread truck. Every day. Running a bread route, joint tucked up under the dash, bottle of tequila in the trash can next to me, flying down the road, and you guys thought you were safe when you saw a bread truck going down the street. But I did that. And one day my boss approached me and he says, "We know you're drinking every day." And he says, "It's going to have to stop or we're going to have to get somebody else." Kind of a wimpy bottom. But it got me to check out Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew a little bit about it from my father. And I came into AA in 1980 with an attitude. And I had a lot of attitudes. I knew what an alcoholic was. You know, an alcoholic's someone under the bridge or behind the dumpster, drinking out of a brown paper bag so nobody knows what he's got, and wearing a trench coat. And that wasn't me. Therefore, I wanted to be there because I liked what you were saying. It was tickling my ears. There's a lot of people, I think, come to AA because it tickles their ears. And it tickled mine. But I hung around AA for 4 years with a closed mind. I think this is why my friend Starlin asked me to yak, but I'll tell you the truth about myself. I was a Christian. I was a Christian. A dope-smoking, coke-snorting, bourbon-drinking Christian. Hallelujah. And I already knew who God was, and you guys did not know. Obviously, you didn't know because you used terms like higher power and God as we understand Him, which I thought was blasphemy. That's some sick stuff. I'll tell you what sick is. Let me tell you what sick is. Sick is a guy who can quote Scripture while drunk, telling you what's wrong with you and backing it up with Scripture. And give me another hit off that bottle. That's sick. And I'm not going to say anything bad about Christianity, but it wasn't doing what it wasn't working for me. I believed it. But a belief is like, I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous you can believe anything you want, but how's that working for you? I was expounding one day, I was waxing eloquently one day about my knowledge to some guy in AA who had many years more than me when I was in that period from 1980 to 84. And he responded with, "How's that working for you?" It's one of the best lines I've ever heard in my life. I just stood there. What's that? Well, not very good. And I started thinking, it wasn't. My so-called knowledge was not keeping me sober. My so-called belief was not keeping me sober. Something was wrong. So, as far as feeling different, for me, my ego would not let me let go of that stuff. And I hung around AA for four years with a closed mind. They say you got to have open-mindedness, willingness, and honesty in order to get this thing. And if you don't have those three, you're not going to get it. I believe that because I didn't get it. In 1984, I went back out drinking. My father died. I used that as an excuse. I had hung around meetings with a closed mind, and I wasn't drinking. The reason I wasn't drinking was because I picked up a couple of things from the people in AA about asking God to keep you sober in the morning and thanking Him at night, and a couple of the other tools to help calm me down, such as easy does it, first things first. Those things were working. But my story, you can disagree with it if you want to, but this is what happened to me. I thought that I was sober if I wasn't drinking. and was still smoking an occasional recreational joint. And I wasn't drinking. Now, what happened for me, I'm pretty sure, is the old man upstairs took the booze when I offered it to him when I said, keep me sober. Because at my level of understanding, I thought just not drinking was sober. But it wasn't. We had a meeting one time, and I said, you can't smoke dope and call yourself sober. And I got done yakking, and some guy in the back of the room pipes up and says, you can't say that. You can't tell us what we can and can't do. Well, he gave himself away. But from that day forward, what happened? But from that day forward, I say, I can't use drugs and call myself sober. Me. But in 84, I went back to drinking because my father died, and I used that as an excuse. There is no excuse, but I used it. And then I hit a lower bottom, and I had a big fight at home, and we had a big row, and everybody was mad, and the roof was coming off, and I was just done. I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. That's a great one, too. I love it. It's me. I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. I was kicking cans, and I had reached my bottom, and that was my bottom. It struck me finally that, Gary, if you're so smart, how come you can't live? Running around talking about God. Sneaking around doing drugs and hiding it. I don't know. There's probably no one else at this convention that has ever done this, but you ever get just as messed up as you can get and then run around trying to act straight? I did it all the time. I don't even know how I pulled it off. I used to get as messed up as a man could get in my bread truck while working, representing this huge company, talking to important people, store owners, store directors, restaurant owners, casinos, while messed up. And I don't know how I did it. I really don't. Visine helps. Someone else told me, if you drink vodka, then you can't smell it. Well, I switched to vodka. And somebody else said, if you eat peanuts, that'll help. You can't smell that. So I'm running around using Visine, eating peanuts and drinking vodka and trying to sell bread. So in 84, I decided to shelf my so-called knowledge, my so-called Christianity. I shelved it. I thought God would punish me for it, and he did not. I thought he'd punish me by turning away from it and paying attention to Alcoholics Anonymous as it's laid out. And I started to do the steps, and I got a sponsor, and I got rid of everything. And that includes drugs and alcohol. And I started praying the prayers that we pray. The Serenity Prayer, the third step prayer, the seventh step prayer, St. Francis of Assisi's in the 11th step. And a prayer that I pray today, more than once a day, at least twice a day, I do this. I have to, because I get caught up in the busyness of the day. I have to start my day over at noon. I just do. I like structure. Anyway, the prayer that I pray twice a day is page 87, 88, 86, 87, 88, upon awakening. I pray that whole thing to God, and it works for me. And the reason I keep doing it is because it works for me. I don't do it thinking that, I don't even think it's going to work sometimes. It just works. The way my head is, I don't want to believe something's going to work, and I'll do it, and then it'll work. That's the way AA is. I don't believe it's going to work, and I do it, and it works. So I got busy with that, and I still had a negative attitude, and I started to recognize the negativity in others in AA. I started noticing them, and then I started turning it around so that I could see if I was doing that. And I'm working on it. I have this natural bent, I think, I have this natural bent to be contrary and be negative and think about bad things. For example, I used to wake up in the morning before my eyes were open, my mind would go to work and say, I'm glad you're stirring. I got something for you to worry about. And I'd wake up worried and mad because of all the plans and schemes and things that I had to get done that I knew I couldn't get done and didn't have time for and hadn't accomplished yet. They all come rushing at me like wild animals. That has changed because of this program. I go to God. I go to God sometimes before my eyes are open, and I say, God, I'm going to put my feet on the floor. You want to get up with me? And it just works. About this negativity and contrariness, it takes a conscious effort for me to catch myself. And when I see it, stop. Don't go there. I try to be more affirmative about stuff as much as I can. I talk to people about the symptoms of alcoholism. The symptoms of alcoholism, to me, aren't drinking. The symptoms of alcoholism are negativity, restlessness, irritability, discontent, the rids. I got to get rid of the rids. Being a perfectionist, highly sensitive. Grandiose. Selfish and self-centered, to the bone. We got a guy in Reno, Big Jack. He always says, I'm an alcoholic to the bone. Selfishness and self-centeredness is the problem, I think. At least as I look at why I have these feelings of difference, that I'm different than you, is because I want to be. I want to stand out. I ain't as bad as you. And hell, I've judged everybody I ever met. I don't know why I've done that. You know, it's. You want to talk about a sick guy? You're looking at one here. Let me share this with you. I've judged everybody I have ever met, but when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had become everybody I ever met. Talk about a people pleaser, sick, judgmental Christian. But I talk to people about the symptoms of alcoholism, and they say a lot. People in AA say a lot. Well, everybody has that. No. Not to the degree that we have them. I've never met an alcoholic yet that doesn't pole vault over mouse turds. You spill your milk, and oh my God, I spilled the milk. You know, it's just milk. And I do. I do it. I still do it. I gotta catch myself doing it. Talking to a pastor at the church, and I told him about these symptoms, and he said, yeah, the same as everybody else. I said, no, not the same as everybody else. Not to the degree that we have them. I remember Chuck Chamberlain used to say we have 10 times the capacity for feeling. I believe that. And I think that what they mean, people saying that everybody has them, is the same thing that I meant. I didn't want to agree that I might be like that. I just didn't want to be that way. I didn't want to think that I was different. But yet I wanted to be different. It was weird. It's just weird how the ego works. Guy in our group at Reno, he says, I'm a garden variety alcoholic. And I've got garden variety sobriety. And man, I really like that. I just latched right on to that one. I need to remember that. It keeps me humble. I start thinking I'm different or special, you know. I really love to share hope in AA. It's my favorite thing, hope. It's not a word. It's a fire inside that. Hearing other people's experience, hope. What it does for me is it lights up a fire inside me to make me want to try something that they're doing so that I can get what they have. And when I try to share hope in Alcoholics Anonymous with the new people, I have a desire that they will try something that they don't understand yet that works. Try it. Just try it. What's it going to do? What's it going to hurt? Try it. So if I can share my experience and give them hope, they might take the steps as they're outlined. I'm going to close with a one of my best stories. I like the story about the guy, the alcoholic that went to. He wanted to find out about God. He wanted to get to know what the meaning of life was and what his purpose in life was and get in touch with God. And he had a lot of money, so he found out that the Dalai Lama couldn't be reached, and he found out that there was someone that the Dalai Lama talks to. And this guru in Tibet, in the Himalayas, had the answer that this man wanted, he thought. So he went there, and he went to this village, and he said, "Where can I find this guru that I have heard about?" They said, "He's up on that mountain. It's going to take you about a half a day to get up there. You better take some water and some food and start early in the morning." And so he starts up there, and he walks and walks and walks for a half a day, and he comes up to a plateau, and he sees a shack. And sitting next to the shack is this bald-headed old man sitting in the lotus position. And he approaches him, and he said, "Are you so-and-so?" The old man says, "What can I do for you, my son?" And he says, "Well," he says, I've come here a long ways. I want to know the meaning of life. I want to know what my purpose in life is. And I want to get in touch with God, closer walk with God. What do you think?" And the old man says, "Don't drink, go to meetings, work the steps, get a sponsor, and help others." And that's it. Thanks.
Oh, thank you, Gary. That's fantastic. And I love sense of humor, too. And I'm going to tell a quick one I heard recently. I could relate to this elderly couple's going up the highway. And the cop car is right behind him with the blue light special. Pulls him off the shoulder of the road. And the husband looks over at the wife and says, "Now, honey, you shut up. I'll do all the talking." The cop came up to the window and he said, "Sir, I'm going to have to cite you for speeding." He said, "No, officer, I wasn't speeding. I had my cruise control on." His wife looked over at him and said, "Honey, I told you 3 times to set that cruise control. You chose to ignore me." He looked over at her and said, "Shut up, honey. I'll deal with you when I get home." He looked back at the cop, and the cop said, "I'm also going to cite you for not wearing your seatbelt." He said, "Oh, officer, I know how valuable your time is, and I saw you coming behind me, and I just quickly released the clip on my belt and reached over to get my paperwork for you." The wife looked at him and said, "Honey, you know that's not true. I told you at least 2 times to put that seatbelt on." And he looked back at her angrily and said, "I said, shut up, I'll deal with you when I get home." And the officer looked over at the wife and said, "Does he always talk to you that way?" She said, "No, officer, only when he's been drinking." Okay. All right, now we've had a pleasure of hearing Libby and Gary. We've got one more to share, and this is Martin, and he's from Canada. So, Martin, step up.
Good afternoon. I, too, am an alcoholic. My name's Martin. This is the original Canadian accent I'm speaking in. And for that matter, the original American one. I just like to have a big book there when I'm speaking, you know, sort of give me some protection. And if anybody's kind of new and they need a big book, please take that one. I would like to thank these folks for having me come down here. What a wonderful week I've had, you know. San Antonio, what a nice town. What a nice town. My goodness. My goodness. Everybody's been talking about drugs, so I'm going to tell you my drug story so you know what kind of guy I am. I got this young guy in the truck the other week there, and he says to me, "You know, Martin, I was out and I done an 8-ball. I says, "What does pool have to do with drugs?" Because, you see, I've never even smoked a cigarette in my life. I was just one of those alcoholics who liked to drink. My favorite drink is a Russian drink, you know, the got the most of. And the full name of it is what you got the most of. And I'm originally from Scotland, you know, so we got a lot of it there, you know. And I just like to drink. You know, I've heard people come to this podium and said, "Oh, I didn't like to drink." And I'm thinking, my God, you're a hero. Can you imagine not liking to drink and ending up an alky anyway? I love drink. I love alkies. You know, I just liked I just like to do, you know, the stuff that we do. You know, all that nonsense that comes with it. You know how they say is here, oh, well, you know, you'll go to places you don't want to be. I was the bouncer at the door. Because I like to be everywhere and I like to do everything. And I'm just one of those guys, you know. I come from a good home, though. You know, I come from a... My granny was Irish. And she was an alcoholic, incidentally, there a little bit. You know, and she never drank her whole life, and my mother never drank in her whole life. You know, but my father took a couple of drinks if it was any money. So I never came from an environment where there was alcohol. I just didn't come from that kind of environment. I just got this disease. I contracted this disease because I just drank too much. You know, and I was 13 when I started drinking, and I was 25 when I stopped. And my dry date is August the 1st, 1983. You know, and you know, by the grace of God and you good folks, that it's been a wonderful journey for me. I've got to do a lot of things and go a lot of places and meet a lot of really, really nice people and some who weren't so nice. And you know, a guy said to me one time, son, if you're like everyone in AA, you ain't going to enough meetings. You know. So I turn up in Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time when I'm 20 years old. I mean, that's kind of young to be turning up here thinking that there's something wrong with your drinking. You know, and I got a brother who brung up in the same house, and he never thought to come here. You know, and he still hasn't. I mean, he's an alcohol abuser too. We were on an aeroplane that sort of crash-landed. Well, it didn't sort of crash-landed, it did. And the guy says to him, you know, they're giving you a drink to sort of soothe you. You know, and the guy says to him, well, what do you want to drink? And he likes that Labatt's Blue. And he says, oh, I'll have a Labatt's Blue. He says, we don't have any of that. He said, well, I'll just have a Coke. That's how he drinks. You know, I'll drink anything. Anything. You know, my brother's wife's got this deadly sense of humor, and they were in one of the big drugstore chains, and they had Scope on sale for 99 cents. And she says to Harry, should we buy a half a dozen of them in case your brother drops over? I just like to drink. You know, I didn't like the pain drink brung. I didn't like the look in the people who I loved the most eyes when I caused the problems that the drink caused. You know, I had a little Irish mother, and she was off the black Irish, you know, black hair and beautiful skin and those shiny blue eyes. And God, I loved Mama. God, I loved her, you know. And I hurt her all the time. And I can never remember getting up in the morning and saying, my mother's going to cry herself to sleep tonight. But she did, lots of times. On the other hand, I had a little father who had no emotion, and he didn't know how to communicate with you, but he loved us, you know. And when I was 19 years of age, he threw me out of Scotland. Go. Where will I go? I don't care. Why? And he took two photographs out of his top pocket, and he showed me one of my mother when she was 46. That's when I was 13 and started drinking. And my mother looked like she was 30. Short black hair and beautiful skin. Oh, she looked gorgeous. And then he showed me this other photograph, and I'm 19. And somebody's painted 25 years on my mama's face. And my father looked at me in the eye, only the way people who love you can look at you in the eye, and said, Martin, you've done this. And I think that's what separates alcoholics from psychopaths. As we have a conscience. And you know, I had put my father in a position in his life where he had to choose between his son and his wife. And I believe my father chose properly because he chose his wife. Because if I had stayed, we would have both died. So I came to O Canada. I tried to come to O America and he wouldn't let me in. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, I like the Americans. Oh, my gosh, I like you folk. I need to tell you, and this isn't, I say this to people all the time, the Yanks are the most generous people in the whole world. They really are. You're such generous people. You so are, you know. And I'm going to have a basket up there for your generosity in about 20 minutes. So I come to Canada, and I'm a stonemasonry trade, and I'm just finished my apprenticeship, and I just get my sitting guilds, and I come and I start working, and I'm 20, and I come to AA for the first time, and I come through the judicial system. That's a nice way of saying the jail, right? And I didn't smoke, And the guy says to me, you should come to AA, Martin. And I said, why? He said, there'll be a woman coming in tonight. And I, where my the range was, I could see them coming in, and it was a woman who was older than my mum. I said, will there be any donuts? No donuts. Well, I'll go next week. But you know, I don't care how the seed's planted. It's not our job to say that the seed's planted properly. It's our job to plant the seed somewhere. And you know, my seed was planted on a rock. And circumstances of my creating blew it into fertile land. And it started to grow. And I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's how it works. Don't worry that you don't get success with the guy you're working with. Just worry that you got to him. You know, and I was in this. We have a bar. I'm sure you have a bar in San Antonio like this. It was this kind of bar on a Friday night. You could go in and you could sort of slug it out. You know, it was like Friday night fights. You know, she's been at it too. But you know, on a Saturday night, it was different. You put a shirt and a tie on and you went to see if you could find a girlfriend. And you know, this accent, people keep saying to me, oh, I can't understand you, you know, but it was never any detriment with women. Women would say to me, oh, I love your accent. And I have to tell you this, when I'm drinking for about 2 or 3 days, I sound like Sean Connery. You know? Because I really am different. I really am. Well, I am, because when I came at 19, I was different to what I was at 21. And I was different to what I was at 25. Because we're changing people all the time, you know. But what I didn't like is I came here to Alcoholics Anonymous and I wasn't different to you guys. What it meant is I fitted in. And I didn't like that too much because I wanted to be noticed. But I was in this bit and it was a bar about the size of this. No, it wasn't as big as this. That's a lie. It was about half the size of this. And I went into this bar and I look over and there she's there. She's blonde and she's blue-eyed. My, she's good looking. She is good looking. And I says to my cousin, I'm going to ask her to dance. He says, Martin, she won't dance with you. I says, why? He says, you've been drinking since Wednesday. You see, alcoholics laugh at that because we know that's ridiculous. If you can stand, you can dance. So I glide over the floor. And I says to this little girl, excuse me, would you like to dance? What I should have said to Cheryl is, excuse me, would you like to go to Al-Anon for the rest of your life? I love the Al-Anons. I love the Al-Anons. It saved my mother-in-law a murder charge. My murder, but it saved her anyway. And I danced with this little girl, and 9 months later we're married, and 11 months after that we have a baby, you know. And I don't like babies very much, because you know what babies demand? Attention. And I was the baby in the house, and I didn't like the competition. Because I'm different. I'm different. And I insulted a doctor that night, and I don't have time, doesn't permit to get into it, but it's a horrible story. And I came to AA that night, you know, and I went to my first AA meeting as like a regular member. Because, you know, don't let anybody in here pull seniority on you. Seniority does not give priority. As soon as you come in here and sit in a seat, you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, the same as everyone else. And I heard this guy talk, and now I know this guy real well today. And I thought he was an old guy, and I'm older than he is today. And I didn't like what he was talking about, so I left, and I went back to the hospital. Cheryl was still in the hospital, and she says, well, how did it go? Oh, I says, bad news, Cheryl. She says, why? I says, well, I think it's like the Masonic Order. She says, what do you mean? I says, I think you've got to be thorough before you can join. She says, Martin, you'll never live until you're 30. And I went in and out, and in and out, and in and out. And have you ever went to a meeting and you hear someone speaking and you think you're a clairvoyant because you know exactly what they're going to say? You think he's going to say this or she's going to say that? My God. Well, that's not clairvoyance. If you really have that clairvoyance, I think there's things that can do to help you with it. But what I had was identification. And for the first time in my whole life, I identified with another human being outside my family. A guy was talking, he was an Irish guy from a place called Glam, and I had never identified with anyone so much, I knew exactly what he was going to say. until he got sober, and then I had no idea what he was talking about. And it's like a journey, a magical journey for us, you know. And so I went up to this little guy, and he says, "You're Harry, Harry's brother, eh?" "Yeah," he says, "he told me you're crazy, eh?" Well, my brother's not bound by the anonymity rules, right? He says, "I'll tell you what, kid, here's my phone number. The next time you get any trouble, you give me a call." I says, "What do you mean the next time, Jimmy? I'm sober 28 days. I'm cured." And this little Irish guy looked at me straight in the face. He says, "Listen, kid, if I tied you by the ankles and hung you up in a smokehouse, you wouldn't be cured in 28 days. And I'm going to tell you something where I come from. And this is, I got a few buddies from my hometown here. This is the thing I like about my hometown. And I know they do it in a lot of towns, and I'm sure they do it in San Antonio. We don't say things to guys like, "Oh, you go to 90 meetings in 90 days, because that's a brush off. That means you go get better, then we'll help you." What these guys do is they take you to 90 meetings in 90 days. And if that doesn't work, they take you to 90 more. And it's really inconvenient when you're trying to have a slip and somebody keeps coming to the door. You know? And this Tuesday night, in 1983, and the Tuesdays, Mark and Mindy used to be on. And I could identify with Mark. But Jimmy says to me, "Martin, I've got some union business to do. I can't go to a meeting tonight." "Yes!" And the door goes at the prescribed time. And I open the door, and there's this big guy called Joe. And Joe says, "Right, in the car." "Oh," I says, "I'm not going to bother tonight, Joe." He says, "Oh yeah, Jimmy told me if I got any of your crap, I can slap you. I'll just go get my jacket." And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to tell you something what I love about Alcoholics Anonymous. There's always hope here as long as you come. But you see, hope isn't recovery. They're two different things. You know, and Jimmy says to me, "You know, Martin, you're going to have to do those things, and they're really inconvenient as well, those steps." I says, "Well, Jimmy, I've done them." I'd done them. I was on a train going to Windsor one time, and I'd done them in 4 hours. And I intellectually understand them. He said, "Good. Now we're going to see if we can get you to emotionally and spiritually understand them." And I'm almost 27 years sober, and I'm not there yet. You know, I think that guy Bill Wilson was a bit of a sneaky kind of guy, you know. Because he wrote this book, "It Keeps Changing." But I'll tell you the secret in this book. See this book here for me. My problem always was, I thought I knew what Bill Wilson meant. And I thought I knew what he was thinking. And so consequently, I wasn't reading these black bits. I was reading the white bits in between. Right? So I had to stop that. And I started doing the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous to the best of the ability of the guy who was teaching me them, because my ability was zero. And I had to get these guys to explain this stuff to me at a level that I had never, ever done before. And you know, we say things in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, it's like peeling an onion. Don't peel an onion, because if you peel it, you'll end up with nothing. Build an onion, and you'll end up with a nice big onion. And when you're building an onion, you're going to cry, because I had to cry. See, when we get to the fourth and fifth step, I had to do my fourth and fifth step, you know, because it's like required. But in the fourth step, it says this. This is the start of a lifelong process. And so that means I'm never over it. I'm never going to graduate from it. And you know, I thought, well, I'll just do that 10-step for it. That'll just be fine. It wasn't even close, because you see, the 10-step is sort of like a dusting of the house. You know, when... And the fourth step is like the spring cleaning. You know, when your wife says, "Honey, here's the list. Now do it." Right? So that's what it is for me. But when I got to the 8th and 9th step, I had this list. And I'm going to tell you, and I only want to talk about this because it's real important to me. I had my man down, and God, I love the folk. I love them. And my father was a little guy, 5'6" or 7", who weighed 120 pounds, top weight his whole life. And he was a hero. He got a medal off the king for the Second World War. He really was a hero. And I loved that little guy. And I thought I didn't love him. I thought I just respected him. But my man knew I loved. My man knew I loved. And you know, I went home and I made amends to them. And this is what I said to them. I said, "Mum, Dad, I'm sorry. And I'm going to try and be a better son. And I'm sorry is the apology. and I'm going to try and be a better son, was the amend. From that day to the day they died, they had no more problems with Martin. I was a better son than my brother. I was as good a son. And you know, I tried to do the same with my wife. Me and Cheryl are married 31 years this year. Well, that's not what she says. She says, listen, big guy, I'm married 31 years. You've got some catching up still to do. So, I tried to be a better son, you know. And to those two daughters of mine, I'll tell you the best compliment I ever got off my daughter. My two daughters were at the porch and I was sitting there hiding from my wife in case she made me do anything. And I'm reading. And my kids were out playing with their buddies and this kid says, oh, my dad is a better dad than your dad. My kid says, don't talk rubbish. My dad would stand in front of a firing squad for me. And I would. You know, because I love him. And I love him so much you wouldn't believe how much I love him. You know, and I'm a different. Of course I'm different. And I want to keep getting different. But I want to be the same at the same time. The ultimate dilemma of the alcoholic. You know? And I'm going to tell you as well, and just in closing, because I hate meetings that go too long. You know? My mother was 70 years of age. 3 score plus 10 in the other good book. You know? And I sent her flowers. You know? And my dad never had money for flowers, so I wasn't trying to upstart my dad. I was just trying to send her flowers. And I called her to Scotland, and I called twice a week, every week, for over 10 years. And I called on Wednesdays and Saturdays, and if there's any guys watching the World Cup right now, you'll know how important soccer is to us guys. We don't even call it soccer. We call it football, right? And I'd call and get the results. But over the years of talking, I was able to build a relationship with my mother. And you know, we used to go home to Scotland 5 times a year to see the soccer, and the rest of the time I get to spend with my mum and dad. And, you know, I sent her these flowers, and she says, Martin, my goodness, those flowers came this morning, son. They're the most beautiful flowers I've ever had. I said, Mum, that's okay. You're worth it. She says, but my mother was a child of the Depression. So everything was important to them. They cut, you know, they would count. You know, she'd send you around for 12 potatoes, and if you bring back 13, you'd go back with one. You know, like, everything was counted. And she says, I was counting those flowers out, Mum, to cut them, and there's only 11 of them. I'm going to go and see that florist. Very Scottish, you know. I says, Ma, take the phone over to the mirror. And obviously she did. I said, Bessie, there's the 12th rose. I never need to buy you 12 roses because I love you. You're my 12th rose. Alcoholics Anonymous set me free. You see, Bill Wilson was asked by a guy called Pete W., who was a trustee, the Eastern Canada trustee at one time. He says, Bill, what does it mean and how it works? And Bill said, without thinking, how freedom works. And that's how freedom works. It's when you intuitively know how you handle situations that used to baffle you. When you're able to tell someone or show someone that you love them and there's no ulterior motives, there's no unequivocal demands, there's just love. And that's what this thing's about. Dr. Bob says in his last, love and service. And so, you know, I love Mama. And gosh, you know, that was the last time I was ever to speak to her. She died 3 days later, suddenly and tragically. But if you had to write a fairy tale about how you were going to end your relationship with your ma, that would be the ending for me. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous done that for me. I got a buddy in the room, and I'm going to finish with this. I sponsor only one woman because I think men for men and women for women, you know. And I sponsor this girl because I'm scared of her. And I actually sponsor her because no woman would. I went and asked 6 women, and this woman says to me, oh, Martin, she terrifies me. I says, I know how you feel. So I sponsor this girl, and this is an important story about redemption. Yvonne goes to the GSR meeting, you know, and if you're not in service, get in service, because sometimes it'd be quite entertaining. And I guess the treasurer had needed a couple of bucks and he had forgot to put them back. And so she choked him. Just until he was blue. And she came round to the house. And I opened the door and she's there and she's in a terrible state. And she says, Martin, I've made a mistake. The first step to fixing something is admitting that it's wrong. And she says, Martin, I've made a mistake. Come in. I said, what's wrong? And she told me. And have you ever seen somebody who's in a lot of pain and you're trying not to laugh? And she said, Martin, I don't have it all together. And that's the secret for Alcoholics Anonymous. Everyone in this room is different. Everyone's different. Every single one of us is our own person, I hope. But you know, she says, I don't have it all together. But let me tell you this, my friends. We have it all together. Thank you.
Thank you, Martin, and Libby, and Gary. We have a few minutes before we close. My name is Sandy, and I'm still an alcoholic. And I forgot to tell you my sobriety date. It is June 2nd, 1994. Thank you. It is through the grace of God and the fellowship of this program that I am alive today. Not incarcerated, not in one of those I love me jackets, because I could have easily been in one of those. Just briefly, back 16 years ago in January, I was on the island of St. Croix. Anybody here from St. Croix? I went there for a second marriage honeymoon. The guy I married, I met on the barroom stool. It was a match made in heaven. He had a little red sports car, a three-piece suit. He had a job. He met my criteria. And I only knew him for 3 months. We know how to pick them. Anyway, I got married, got his birth certificate, found it in his little folder at his place of business for him. There were two folders. One said bankruptcies, and the other said divorces. And in my alcoholic thinking, I went ahead and married him anyway. So I don't know if any of you have ever pulled that stuff. But here I am on the island of St. Croix in January of 1994. 3 days on the island. It had been whittled away with the storm, so we decided we were going to be adventuresome and go on a big little road trip. We got up to this little cabana, and the natives were playing dominoes, and we asked the gentleman at the bar, what do you do to have fun and here on the island? And they said, well, the customers buy a case of beer or a six-pack and go out back and drink with Tony's offspring. And I said, well, what's Tony's offspring? They said, it's a hog. So I said, well, that sounds like fun. So we got our beer. We went out back, and the hog, you entice it to come over to the rail. It put its hooves up on the rail, put a beer can in its mouth. It crushed the can. You'd hear the proverbial pop, you know, escape, and guzzle, guzzle, guzzle. And then it strategically flipped the can out of its mouth in this huge pile of beer cans, and the tab would come off the tip of its tongue. I looked over at my husband, Jim, and I said, watch me, honey. I think I can do that. So, you know, when you think about things that are different, I am not drinking with hogs today. So that's progress, not perfection. You know, the things we do and we think it's normal. When I came into the fellowship at Quaker's House in Winchester, Virginia, I went to 5 meetings in one day. And if there had been another meeting, my butt would have been there. I cried at every meeting I went to. 2 weeks later, this Neanderthal, 6'4" gentleman came up, tapped me on the shoulder, and he said, how are you doing today, ma'am? I said, I'm in a little bit better space than I was 2 weeks ago when I was here. He looked down at me and said, I felt your pain. I prayed for you. I burst into tears again, and I said, sir, you don't even know me. I can't believe you prayed for me. I learned something from that gentleman. I know God put that man in that room that day to pray for this suffering alcoholic. And, you know, it's been such a journey ever since. I went to a Blue Mont Mountain meeting to get my 30-day chip. And this beautiful man came over from Shepherdstown, West Virginia, and gave me the softbound version of the big book, first 164 pages. And he wrote his name in the front, his sobriety date, and put in love and service and signed his name and his phone number. He referenced page 62. And I turned to page 62, and you know what the man had the nerve to underline for me? So basically, we think we're the making of our troubles. And I looked at him, and I thought, you don't even know me, sir, and you're taking my inventory. There's something wrong with this picture. You know, and he saw it on my face, and he said, Sandy, when you get back to your home, I want you to get your real big book out and look at the end of the chapter on Dr. Alcoholic Addict in the third edition. And you look down two-thirds of the way on the page. Find a sentence that ends with a question mark. I knew he was baiting me. Well, I went back home and I looked that up. And the 5 little words were, how important is it really? You know, my sobriety is the most important thing in my life today. With that, you know, by myself, I am nothing. The Father doeth the work. And, you know, when I'm thinking about things of difference, my first sponsor used to tell me, if nothing changes, nothing changes. And I was that person that had to get sick, real sick and sick and tired before a light was lit under my butt. The answers are in the steps. I do believe that with all my heart. When I got to that 9th step amends with my first husband of a 19 and a half year marriage,
My dad, when he died an alcoholic death 2 years before our separation, he left half of my family estate for me to share with that husband. Now, if you talk about a resentment, folks, when I had to write those checks to him, and it took me 23 years to settle my dad's estate, it was so messed up. You know, leave it up to an alcoholic to try to resolve an estate. But you know, after 5 years, when I came into the fellowship, I wrote those checks year after year after year. And I finally, after 5 years in the program, got a thank you note for him. I rushed over to my home group and I said, "Thank God, the man finally thanked me for this money. You know, if I keep coming back long enough, maybe he'll put the check in the envelope and say, 'Here, honey, keep it. It's really yours.'" You know, and you know what they had the nerve to say? "Keep coming back, Sandy." You know, life is so grand today. You know, when our daughter got married 4 years ago and we sat at that wedding together side by side, it was because of the ninth step amends that I was able to look at that man with a different pair of glasses and, number one, say, "You know, my dad, it was his money. It was up to him to decide how to disperse it." And secondly, the revelation of he loved him and wanted to express that love for him. You know, it's a live and let live. So for those that are struggling with this disease today, just keep coming back. Put the cork in the bottle. You know, bring the body, the mind will follow. And that 90-90 that was mentioned, when I first heard about that, I thought they were talking about 90 proof, and I said, "I'll vote for that." You know, so it is a learning process. So thank God for the chips you hold today. Keep putting that hand out there to assist and to help the newcomer. The literature tells us we are to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to the God of our understanding and our fellow being. So God bless you.